Okay, there's six ideas there. Okay. I'm going to do them in reverse order. Difficult and complex. What's important about that, and what is it in music? And why is it something that you had any attraction to at all?
It felt at the time like it was expansion of consciousness. That is, that one was really achieving a wider range of awareness, because you were able to deal with more complex and other kinds of musical scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, I think, essentially, and that was tied up with the psychedelic, you know.
Okay, so I was going to back up into that. Now, let's see, how much were people using psychedelics at that point?
A lot.
Uh-huh.
A lot. Everybody around me, just right. Absolutely routine.
Regardless of class, regardless of background.
Oh, absolutely. It was just everywhere.
And in concert music, it was like that. And so, okay, good. That evens out. That removes one question. I mean, I do you presume that your interest in what those people were playing came from doing the acid or not?
No.
Did you think that the acid expanded your consciousness the way that the complexity did?
I actually found the acid to kind of be a pain in the ass.
Okay, and so, but how much of the acid taking did you get into it?
Not anywhere near as much as my friends.
Okay.
I was much more very occasional. Mm-hmm. I didn't really like the insomnia.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I couldn't deal with the insomnia end of it. And I was also, fairly neurotic kid anyway. I suffered from social anxiety disorder, which I didn't realize until I was much, much older. And I was prone to depression. And the thing about the acid is I could kind of feel the schizophrenia kicking in. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was always a highly intellectual experience. And it would make me very manic and nervous, and the thoughts would be uncontrollable. And so I kind of thought it was a pain in the ass because of the uncontrollableness of it. Because I wanted to expand my consciousness, but I wanted to keep the expansion day to day, not have it just depend upon, like, okay, I'm taking this drug, and so now I'm expanded, but now it's over, and now I'm back where I started from, or I'm in some other deluded state. And also, I could see my friends becoming deluded from it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, let's come back from there, just a piece. So, tell me about what you thought was great, so interesting about Tony Williams that you were driven, or maybe you were just driven. When was it, a physical experience? Was it a mental? What did you see there that you hadn't seen, and why was it exciting?
It was mental and physical.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was just like, look, in terms of rocking, like, you know, just like cock out, chest pounding rocking, they rocked harder than anything I had ever seen or heard.
What did that mean to rock at that point?
The same thing it means today, whatever
which
that is, thing
whatever
is
that
is, AC/DC.
Okay,
I mean, I don't really.
No, that's cool. You know. The only reason I ask is because we're talking about the words and symbols. We started off talking about the words.
It was very authentic and convincing, and the thing. Rock music uses volume. They were loud, but it wasn't even the volume. It was like the energy of it was all-consuming, and it does that in a physical way, because, you know, like the rhythms themselves create mirror neuron reactions that, you know, suddenly your body is experiencing things that you weren't aware that you could even think of, especially when you're listening to Tony Williams play the drums, and there also was that amazing new language that comes from combining the kind of pentatonicism of the African stuff with the more sophisticated chromaticism of the Western stuff. And so there were like colors in the sounds of the harmonies and melodies that excited me.
Uh-huh.
And the virtuosity. I was very much into virtuosity. I was you know, so people could play fast. That was really impressive, and those guys could really play fast.
So, what did you think that there was a reason why they were choosing to present that then, when they had all those options? Clearly, I mean, these were massive musicians, they'd already been through a good deal of American music history.
Oh, I didn't ever. The question didn't occur to me at the time. I mean, it's just like, you know.
Like, that's the only way. The way I'm looking at it is the only way to do it.
Well, also, you know, the other thing about it was that those concert experiences, mm-hmm. right? I mean, going to see Mingus at Lincoln Center,
mm-hmm.
and for Christ's sakes, it's Lincoln Center,
right?
You know, and then going to see Mahavishnu Orchestra, and they ask for the silence before they play,
mm-hmm.
and then going to the Village Vanguard, where they don't serve drinks during the set. At least they didn't back then. I mean, it was like, you know, they were really serious about, like, if you're here, you're not allowed to, we don't talk while the music's playing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're really there for the music. And so there was this other thing, too, of, like, taking this stuff very seriously and really concentrating and experiencing it, as opposed to having a beer and chatting with your friends and trying to pick up a girl while this music is going on.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and somewhere around in that time, also, though, I was a friend of mine's, they had the first lottery for tickets for a rock show, because the Rolling Stones were going to play New York for the first time since Altamont.
Mm-hmm.
And these girls that I knew sent in tickets with everybody's name they knew, and they got tickets, and so I went to see the Rolling Stones and sat in the 8th row. And they were playing, and the opening band was Stevie Wonder with Wonder Love. And that was also an absolutely amazing, mind-boggling experience. And mm-hmm. the social level of it, the, you know, what that audience felt as that show went down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then to have the Stones come out. And at the end of the show, I think it was Mick Jagger's birthday, maybe, or something. And I remember there being a big cake. And at the end of the show, they came out with Wonder Love and played together a set of Little Stevie Wonder.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and when they hit Uptight, everything, oh, it was...
Wow.
And so I also had, I didn't have the idea that there were two different things going on.
It was all the same.
It didn't occur to me at all that there was, like, two different things going on, you know.
Okay, so before I
come in contact with people who didn't like types of music,
right? Uh-huh.
I mean, it was there, but we didn't know about it because they weren't really exposed to it.
Okay, and so that solves a certain problem. Then I can ignore the specific discussion of the previous artists. I'm really just trying to work out why these gigs, what you saw in these people that may have both triggered you and may actually have started you thinking about various kind of ideas. As I take it, you probably spent a lot of time since then, tearing that.
Yeah, no, it became a very. I mean, it turned into a very hard life lesson, as you know, because the band. I mean, you know, here we are. We're 15, 16 years old, and we have a reputation, you know, in an area-wide reputation. But also, it's like people would come and they would be utterly blown away.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that what we were doing was so intense and so specific, and so it was sort of like, you know, if you're going to go out and perform Beethoven's Ninth, well, you or I might try to go see it more than once in a run.
Mm-hmm.
But most people, you know, like, maybe once every 3 years is as much as they need to hear Beethoven's Ninth in a live setting.
Right.
You know, and so here we are doing this thing, and then you're trying to work. And, yeah, the first night was always incredible success.
Mm.
And this happened a bunch of times where club owners gave us, and so I'm like, I'm 15, 16 years old, I'm underage,
mm.
I'm playing in the premier clubs in the area.
Mm.
We go in the first night always and absolutely blow everybody away. They can't believe that they're hearing kids play like this.
Mm-hmm.
They give us the weekly,
mm-hmm.
and by the third week we're fired because nobody's in the club.
Mm-hmm.
Because who's going to go back and see The Exorcist 14 times, you know? Mm-hmm. You just don't do that.
Right.
Whereas, you know, my other friends who were playing, like, the Stones covers, people would come and see them over and over and over again because it was about the social life more than the music, you know? It's about being on the scene, being in the social setting of it, and So I immediately contacted this difference between the intense listening experience music versus the creation of social scene kind of music or something.
Why do you feel, do you have a feeling about why the popular appeal was in the Rolling Stones covering Fellows rather than the Complex Fellows?
Do I have a feeling about it?
Or what is it? What is it about Rolling Stones music, particularly, that's attracting people?
Well, I think
that way. what do you think?
They're very, very good at creating cultural resonance by playing music that at one time is creative and interesting, and at the same time stays within the boundaries of people's scenario creation stuff. But then also, you know, the thing, you can't take out the emotional power of it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an emotional power to that stuff, which comes from the blues and or whatever. And
is that the same when you talk about that? Is that the same power that is in when you say something rocks, and is that the same power that is in the intensity that you would have heard at the Tony Williams show?
Well, it's not entirely the same thing as what was at the Tony Williams show. You know, this was a special time.
I mean, I'm only asking because it's, you know...
You know, at that time, I remember this is the time of the heyday of prog rock and fusion.
Mm.
And so, I mean, people were listening to Yes, you know, and not just Yes, King Crimson, Flash, Gentle Giant. And there was a lot of people who were into a lot of kinds of, you know, stuff that had, and, you know, an art. Weather Report and the early Return to Forever stuff, and the Mahavishnu Orchestra, and I think there were a lot of us at that time, musicians who were roughly my age, who simply assumed that this was the way things were going to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this was the new music, and this was the way things were going to be, and then there was a tremendous backlash against that.
When did that backlash start?
Say by 74 it had started, and by 75 it was pretty well kicked in.
And what was the idea of the backlash? What was their idea about it? What did you feel were the ideas?
The idea of the backlash, I think, was we don't need all this. This complexity is a pain in the ass and distracting from the. I think this is the idea of it. From the underlying. What you really need is simple and direct and emotionally powerful statements. And there was also, you know, at that time, there's the shift from the world of the progressive culture as it was, you know, which we call the hippie culture, but it's really so much more than that. That term really isn't at all accurate, to the disco. Right, and I think that for a lot of people, there was a sense of that everyone had been too serious, and it was time to lighten up. On the one hand, and there were people who started, you know, snorting cocaine and listening to disco music and just wanting to party. And on the other side, there were people who were exhausted and started listening to more like James Taylor and kind of retreating into hobbitdom. You know, and these were like the two different things that one was dealing with by the mid-70s.
Mm-hmm. So I want to ask one question. I got to go because, unfortunately, but I think a good place to stop at least this part is to say... What was Arthur Cunningham's feeling about those particular musical forces that were going on in relation to his idea of himself as a jazz musician? Or were you aware that he had any? I mean, if you mentioned Mingus, or if you were to mention
about Mingus and Tony Williams and stuff. I mean, he had studied with Teddy Wilson, and he knew these guys, you know.
So he knew those musicians.
Yeah, I mean, he had lived with Cecil Taylor, and
okay, so he was already that.
He was completely aware guy in terms of that. I don't think he paid that much attention to the rock thing, but that it wasn't his world.
Uh-huh.
But he didn't put it down.
Yeah,
you know, it just wasn't his world.
Mm-hmm.
He was consummately. Another thing that he was interested in teaching me was how to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, amongst the things that he taught me how to play cocktail piano. But he did it specifically with the idea of, and I can remember him saying this to me, you know, if you're playing the piano some night and an old woman comes up to you with tears in her eyes and she wants to hear Danny Boy, you'd better be able to play it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he would also tell me these stories about how he would go on vacation and... So when he wanted to go on vacation, he would just call up the cruise line, and then he would go and get on the boat, and he would play the piano for a couple hours every night and then have his vacation.
Mm-hmm.
Or when he was young, he wanted to travel, and so he took off, and he would just drive to whatever town, find the bar with the piano, sit down at it, and make, you know, enough money to find a meal and a nice hotel room, and then move on to the next place. So, you know, so he had the skill of... This kind of jazz, solo jazz piano playing, which was it was solo jazz piano playing in the tradition of like Art Tatum and stuff.
That's very complicated.
Yes, yes, it was very, very complicated. Yeah, oh, he could play that. I mean, he really could play the piano. You know, at that time he was writing big commissions and stuff.
Mm-hmm. For who?
Well, the time that I worked with him, he wrote a commission for the Harvard Wind Ensemble.
Mm-hmm.
And they were featuring a tuba player who could play multiphonics. I remember because he was working out all this stuff with multiphonics. And
so he was writing for a tuba player.
And I remember he was writing a kind of a rock opera. I think he was one of the first guys to write rock opera. But he was doing something with it had to do with Gullah people. Gullah people are the people who live in the Atlantic lowlands and on the islands in South Carolina and Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
They're in an African American community where the like the New Orleans one, where they were largely left alone, and so they managed to preserve a lot of their mm-hmm. older culture. He also had a commission, I remember, for some orchestra somewhere, for a piece that was for some famous contralto and Charlie Byrd, the guitarist.
Yeah.
He had commissions rolling in.
Yeah,
he had a piece done, you know, he had written a piece for the LA Philharmonic that Maida had done. And in fact, when I was in graduate school, towards the end of my graduate school, Maida rolled out that piece. And it was fascinating to me because every time an American composer was played by the New York Philharmonic, everybody at the Columbia, you know, thing, they would all go apeshit and go, oh, and it would be the talk of the town. Arthur had his piece played and none of them even noticed.
Hmm. And
I think largely because he was black. And they were racists.
At what time when did you stop taking lessons with Arthur Cunningham?
I stopped taking with Arthur, I stopped working with Arthur probably when I was 19.
So a year into Columbia already.
Yeah.